Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. So, you know, we had to cut the program short again last week because we love talking about Robert C. Thaler's novella, A Whole Life. We just can't quit. But anyway, let's get right back into it. And today we are going to discuss our final thoughts on the book. So I do have with me Daryl Hope today, and I have my wife, Deborah Leap, here with me today. And so welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, good. So, Derry.
Yes.
I've known Daryl Hope for a long time, so I call him Derry. So, but anyway, I'm sure he doesn't mind.
It's my Irish nickname.
So. Yeah, it's his Irish nickname. Yeah. Yeah, mine's Kevin. But anyway, we won't get into that today. We're going to find that. We have to find a good Irish book for this winter series, so... But, Derry, let's have you take the mic and tell us your final thoughts on A Whole Life.
Okay, well, generally speaking, the book is just, I think, a delightful and very easy read. It's very easy to follow. It's nature-oriented, very appealing from that standpoint. There is a real simplicity about the language, but it's packed. The book is just packed with imagery, packed with metaphors. There's this constant contrast between absurd and serious, between evil and good in a lot of ways. And so you're running through these sort of mental contrasts and metaphors in a lot of physical metaphors that he uses. And then you're in the setting of the mountains, in this beautiful setting of the mountains. So he has sort of all of this content and this beauty of language, this simplicity of language in this very beautiful setting, which makes for a really enjoyable read, makes it very, very enjoyable. And there is something about the book that I would say is definitely what I would call the Deutsche spirit, because he is an Austrian author. You know, there's a famous German poet, Heinrich Heine, who said that the German mind really has two spirits. One spirit is the Deutsche spirit, which is the one that has to do with beauty and music and all the wonderful things you think about when you think of Germany. And then there's this other spirit called the Teuton, the Teutonic spirit, which is the spirit of war and crushing and all those kinds of things. And this book is very much the Deutsche spirit. It's the spirit of beauty and loveliness and balance. And I think that comes out a lot as you read the book. And it brings out, even Barrett's very title, which is, you know, A Whole Life, certainly brings out the question of, well, what constitutes a whole life? What is it about a whole life that makes a life whole? And looking at this book, you see that it's really sort of communicated in simplicity. That simplicity of life really makes a whole life. It doesn't really have to be a lot of things that you do. You don't have to be traveling. You don't have to have a lot of things. you can really have a whole life just by character and by developing character and moving through life that way, as he does from a human standpoint. But it's really from a very human standpoint he does that.
Yeah, I think that it's clear that Andreas has great character. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about a lot, personally, we talk a lot about spiritual character, but there is just a basic human morality that I think he exemplifies right. In the book. I mean, he has one love in his life. You know, he's not going to... you know, go out whoring or anything like right. that. He's had one love. He takes care of himself. He's not relying on welfare.
Right.
He looks out for other people, and it is like you said. It's his character is what keeps bringing him back positively, right. Even when he's in the Russian front, he's freezing on this mountaintop, and he's still loyal.
Right.
He's waiting for them to bring him food, and they're not coming, you know, but he stays there. And so it is really, I think it's really a remarkable quality. And I think we can all say that we know someone like that, that they don't have to necessarily be very religious people, but they're just they're very moral people.
Right.
And they do want to contribute to other people's lives and take care of them if they can. It is really, it's a really great quality.
And this is probably the kind of common stock of person that you would have seen 75 years ago. This was the common person would have been more like this type person that Andreas Eger is. And so it really sort of harks back to an earlier, simpler time when people had more of those types of values. One of the things I'd say about the book that I think is very interesting, I think requires a study really, is the choice of names that the authors use. Because he uses names that connect in sort of strangely coincidental ways. And I wonder if it's really those were thought out or if it's just by happenstance. I imagine it was probably thought out. We've talked about the name Andreas Eger, Eger being actually a harrow or a plow. So it sort of relates to someone who's very earthy and sort of works the land and sort of has that kind of connection with the earth. And then one of the individuals in the book, whose name is Anna Holla, we've spoken about her. She was sort of the old maid school teacher who came late on and tried to have a friendship with Andreas.
I think I called her the avalanche.
Yeah. And she was in some ways. but she her name is very interesting because Holla is a dialectical version of the word Holunda, which in German means an elder bush. And an elder bush is a bush that is green and has flowers, and it's makes tea. You could have teas from that make that are very healthful and life-giving. And so it's like she has this name that has this sense of giving life and giving things, which she did obviously as a teacher. But that's not the way it translates in the book. In the book, she doesn't come across as being a tree of life. she doesn't come across that way. And again, that's sort of the contrast that you see throughout the book. You see these contrasts of a name meaning one thing, and sometimes it relates to that, and then sometimes it doesn't. And you see incidences of funny things happening in very serious settings and absurd things happening in serious settings.
I think I really like when you say that. We really needed you for this book with the German background that you have. But if you – could it be even with Anna, with her last name, Holler, one of the bushes that we grew up with at my home, my grandfather, who was Irish, very Irish grandfather, he was a great gardener, and he planted this elderberry bush, which was – I mean, we had elderberry jam. We had elderberry juice. You know, it was a beautiful bush in the spring and had these beautiful leaves and all that. But could it be that Anna just wasn't the right health potion for Andreas?
The time wasn't right.
he just was happy with Marie. And right. He had, 4 years with her, and that was enough for him. I mean, there's things that I wanted to say. But everyone's heard me enough anyway. But the thing is for him, she just wasn't the right potion, you know. So, but I definitely just wanted to say that, you know, having been, a writer for, we've been married 43 years. And so my whole life career has been writing. And writing is the hardest job. And I've never talked with Robert C. Thaler. I'd love to talk to him, but you'd have to translate for me. But I know those things don't happen by chance right. When someone writes. If you look at Andreas Eger, there's one part of the book where he even talks about the blue leasel being a plow through the mountains. Right. I mean, it's there.
Right.
And so, so I was trying to get that across to our sophomore English students because we do require them not only to read the books, we require them to be able to write and analyze and all that. And that even though the book is, 150 pages, it probably took him months to develop the story. You know, students, in college, they think, well, I give them usually their end assignment by mid-semester, and I know they wait till the night before. And you can tell that they did it the night before. But Robert C. Thaler did not write this book the night before he had it published. Right. You know, you don't know how many editors went through it. You don't know how many times he rewrote it. And that, you know, the rumor on the street is that Hemingway rewrote The Old Man and the Sea. He edited it 200 times. Mm. And I believe it. And so those things don't happen in the book by chance, by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, and these names that that authors place on characters are very important, just from the way that the name sounds, and also from any kind of image the name might connect. Because when you would think, what would be the most appropriate name that he could give the wife of Andreas Egger? Well, he gives her the name Mary.
Yeah.
Maria. So, yeah. So what better name would there be to choose to give a name to a wife that's appreciated and loved so much and has almost a spiritual connection to it than to give the name Maria?
He says in that New York Times interview that I talked about, I forget how many programs we've done now. I mean, way back there. He said this book is a myth. He said it's not. He designed the characters. He designed the story. Sure, it's based on, I mean, he did live in the Alps. I mean, he is Austrian. He knows people like these characters, but he said they're not based on real people, and I believe that. And then when you bring up the meaning behind the names, you can see him just sitting back and thinking, well, you know, this is the story I want to write. And then there is a term that most writers know about. It's called organic. And the best writing is organic. In other words, you have a germ of an idea, but it grows. It's, you know, you don't just, I mean, he probably didn't sit down and outline the whole book with every little phase. He probably had a general outline. And then when he got into writing, he'd think, well, maybe we should do this, or maybe I should do that. You know, I don't think he sat down and said, well, now the cold lady, I'm going to give her the scar on the back of her neck because it's going to be exactly like Marie's. You know, that develops, and that's what they call organic. It has to be that way. And so it really, as a writer, if you let that happen, you know, when I write, I usually just do broad outlines and then it's almost like the article tells you the story as it goes. I know that sounds a little crazy, but that's really the way it happens.
Well, it's a wonderful creative process.
Yes.
And that creative process plays out, you know, in certain ways, with different ways with different people. But it is that creation of a work, whether it's a piece of art or whether it's a piece of writing, whatever, it's the creative process, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, in fact, reading this book, I don't know. He's written some other things. I don't know if they're translated into English or not. We'd have to check it out. So maybe it will do. There's another one he's written I would really like to read. Supposedly it's really good, even better than this one. But I think it's still written in German, so you'd have to read it for me and then translate it for
me.
So, Deborah, surely you have a final thought.
Yes, I do. I have some more things to say. Well, I really, after hearing what Daryl was saying about contrast again, it just hit me. There's this one passage I wanted to read about him kind of summarizing his whole life, and then at the end, I think it's interesting what he says, and there's a contrast. You'll see the contrast there. It's about humor, and I realize that C. Thaler does. There's always a lot of humor in some of the darkest scenes. Like usually, it seemed like every time there was a funeral procession, there was something funny that happened. You know, like even with Krenstocker, there was the boy watching TV, you know, and laughing. And of course, with his grandmother, there was the whole funny scene with her arm flapping. So it seemed like there's always something funny with death. And so I just want to read this here. I'll read this whole thing right here about his, at the end of his life. According to his birth certificate, which in his opinion wasn't even worth the ink on the stamp, Egger lived to be 79 years old. He had held out longer than he himself had ever thought possible, and on the whole, he could be content. He had survived his childhood, a war, and an avalanche. Those are things he had to survive. He had survived his childhood. He had never felt himself to be above doing any kind of work, had blasted an incalculable number of holes in rock, and had probably felled enough trees to heat the stoves of an entire town for a whole winter. Over and over again, he had hung his life on a thread between heaven and earth, and in his latter years as a tour guide, he had learned more about people than he was able fully to understand. As far as he knew, he had not burdened himself with any appreciable guilt, and he had never succumbed to the temptations of the world, to boozing, whoring, and gluttony. He had built a house, had slept in countless beds, stables, on the backs of trucks, and even a couple of nights in a Russian wooden crate. He had loved, and he had had an intimation of where love could lead. He had seen a couple of men walk about on the moon. He had never felt compelled to believe in God, and he wasn't afraid of death. He couldn't remember where he had come from, and ultimately he didn't know where he would go. But he could look back without regret on the time in between his life with a full-throated laugh and utter amazement. So there he's laughing at him. I mean, isn't that something? You know, it's like the whole life, and he ends with a laugh. So I just realized that right now. About the last. So anyway, it's interesting it was kind of like that's his philosophy of life, is it? You know, that there's good and the bad, you know, but it's, you know, you have to laugh about it, and that's part of his contentment. So,
well, there are a lot of things in life that really maybe aren't funny when you're going through them, but when you look back at them, they are funny. Right. I mean, you've lived with me for a long time, and you know, I look back at some of the things I've said and done, and I just crack up thinking, how did you put up with all that all these years? So I think it's as Derry was saying, it shows the German practicality, mm-hmm. is that you can have a whole life and you don't have to be anything more than a lumberjack.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, but if you're content, if you're happy, you know, and of course that is one of the big Christian values in the Bible. Right. It's called you have character or godliness with contentment. You're just content with what God has given you. And, you know, you don't need, you know, choice steaks every night of the week, because if you have a choice steak every night of the week,
you don't appreciate it.
It's boring.
You don't appreciate it.
Right. It's boring. Yeah. So anyway, I think that's really, really amazing that he did do all those things. I mean, you know, and I think in many ways he had a lot of variety in his life.
He did.
You know, it's not like he was just one thing all of his life. He had a lot of variety. So again, that's very interesting. So was there anything else?
Well, just if you want to talk about at the very end, I said.
Yes, but I want to talk about, you two feel like you're given enough final thoughts?
Oh, yes, yes.
Because, you know, I can have an hour of final thoughts. Yes.
I just want to know what you all think about what happens at the end. That's why I want to know.
Okay, we'll get to the end. So here's how we're going to get to the end. One of the things when we get into our classes and we analyze writing, is I always tell the students to look for symbols and motifs. Now, we've talked a lot about symbols in this book. And, you know, in other words, if you're going to be a good reader, you have to learn to analyze what you're reading. In other words, are there meaning behind the names? And I think there are. And one of the big motifs, or maybe the biggest motif in this book, is a description of the mountains. I mean, it's almost like his whole life. I know Marie was a fulcrum, and certainly in his life, but if you look at what really gives him the peace and the contentment, it's being in the mountains. That's his stability in life. And even at the end of the book, the mountains are so important to him, he actually, you know, moves into a house that is partly into the mountain. And so it is. It's really amazing. And I always tell students that when you read the book the first time, that's just shallow reading. It's not really effective reading. You almost have to read a book two or three times. And now I think this is like the third time I've read it, and you see more each time. But if we just go back to page 11, a really good writer also, he sneaks the motif in, and I call it that way. It's kind of just snuck in on you. And you don't really get it unless you really go back and reread it. And the thing is, this whole idea of the mountains is talked about from the very beginning of the book. And if you would both, let's say that because you've been on this panel with me, if you both would now go back in your books, and every time you read the word mountain, you mark it, you can see it's almost on every page. There's a phrase or involvement into the mountain. But let's just go to the bottom of page 11. I just want to read to start reading some of this. It says, as a child, Andreas Egger had never shouted or cheered. He didn't even really talk until his first year at school. With difficulty, he had scraped together a handful of words that at rare moments he would recite in random order. Talking meant attracting attention, which was never a good thing. He arrived in the village as a small boy in the summer of 1902, brought by a horse-drawn carriage from a town far beyond the mountains. So that's one of the first pages where he talks about mountains. But notice his reaction. He says, when he was lifted out, he stood there, speechless, eyes wide, gazing up in astonishment at the shimmering white peaks. And so he's just totally impressed by the mountains as soon as he gets there. Now, if you look just right down at the very bottom of the page, it's still the same scene, and we've read part of this before. It says, so now here Egger stood, gazing at the mountains in wonder. This was the only image he retained of his early childhood, and he carried it with him throughout his life. And so you can see that here, Seethaler just sets us up right from the beginning, that these mountains are very important. And it is a motif that runs, through the book. Let's go look at page 25. I'll just, again, show you very quickly how, he was impacted by the mountains. And this also not only is a motif, but this is what we would call, in elements of style, it's an arresting image. It's so well written that it gives you this picture. It says, he's talking about, being on the mountain. He's talking about being on one of the meadows. It says that he would think about his future, which extended infinitely before him, precisely because he expected nothing of it. And sometimes, if he lay there long enough, he had the impression that beneath his back the earth was softly rising and falling, and in the moments like these, he knew that the mountains breathed. So, to him, the mountains were life. They were alive. They were, Daryl has said throughout, there's these contrasts where nature is beautiful, but nature is very dangerous. And, the mountains were alive. They breathed. But also, there was an avalanche. They killed, and so that's really there. Let's skip ahead now to page 31. There's just these few snippets of writing, and you can find many, many more. Let's see. I think this is another one. This is the bottom of page 31, is why did he like the mountains so much? It says, and he's comparing himself, I think, really with Cranstalker. He's not like Cranstalker. Cranstalker was a farmer and a clod, really. but Egger, he didn't want to be a farmer. It says, being a farmer meant spending your whole life crawling around on your clod of land with your eyes lowered, scratching at the earth. His kind of man, this is talking about Andreas, his kind of man, needed to lift up his eyes and look as far as possible beyond his own small, limited patch of ground. Mm-hmm. How could you do that if you weren't living on a mountain? You can't see far enough. And Cranstalker couldn't see beyond his whip or his, soaking his little, whipping stick.
Yeah, in your whole discussion here, I'm having... The hills are alive with the sound of music going through my head.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I just want to bring out another one. This is kind of going to be a little bit longer. But I just think we ought to just need to pay attention to this. It says, in later life, this is the top of the page 32. In later life, Egger couldn't remember ever having talked as much as he did that day Marie first visited his cabin. Now, remember, they're up in the mountains. He says the words simply tumbled out of him. and he listened to them in astonishment as they lined up, seemingly of their own accord, to create a meaning that became apparent to him with surprising clarity only after he had spoken them. Now, as they descended the narrow, winding path to the valley, Edgar fell silent again. He felt strange and a little embarrassed without knowing why. They stopped for a while to bend in the path. He sat in the grass, leaned their backs against the trunk of a fallen beech. The wood had stored the warmth of the last days of summer and smelled of dry moss and resin. All around them, the mountains rose up into the clear sky. Marie thought they looked as if they were made of porcelain, and although Edgar had never seen porcelain in his life, he agreed with her. He said, "You'd have to be careful walking there," he said. "One false step and the whole landscape might crack or shatter or straight away into thousands of tiny landscape splinters." Marie laughed. "That sounds funny," she said. But notice that when they were up on the mountain, he just could talk. He could be really glib, I guess. I should say glib. And yet he knew the mountains were dangerous.
Right.
But he still loved them. They were like porcelain. They were beautiful to him. So anyway, I think that's really, really great. I know we're running out of time again. Do you think we have time to get to page 143? I think that's where we all want to be. This is the story when about 6 months before he died. He got nervous, and maybe we just tell the story as he got nervous and he wanted to take a bus ride. And he takes the bus and he goes far into another village. He gets off the bus, gets lost, gets back on the bus, comes all the way back home. And what was his reaction?
He had been homesick.
He had been homesick.
And that's what he liked. He liked the feeling of coming home.
Yeah. And he wanted to come home to the mountains. Mm-hmm. And so that's really... that's really very important. So did you have one last comment you want to make there?
No, I think everything's been said. But it was just the idea at the end there. People wonder, why did he get on the bus and go away? That people thought he was crazy. But he realized when he came back, he missed that feeling of coming home.
He just wanted the feeling of coming. Right. I know our sophomore students thought he had Alzheimer's. They thought he went psychotic or something.
But I think it's interesting. He ended the book that way. He ended the book rather than with his death, which occurs prior to the ending of the book. Mm-hmm. His death occurs, and then there's this flashback now of 6 months earlier. So there's really, he brings life back into the book after death. You know,
right.
It's interesting the way it's done.
Right. So the book really does end, I think, on a very positive note. All right. So that's it for the C. Thaler book, A Whole Life. And so we'll be looking forward to having you read H's for Hawk, and we'll be getting into that in a few weeks. So be sure to check out our Twitter and Facebook pages. And be sure to like and comment about us. We need comments. There's a lot of competition at JBL about getting comments. I need some comments. We will be sharing some more tweets on future programs. And remember, the next book we're going to be discussing is Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk. Be sure to get your copy. Dive into that captivating story. It's about falconry. It's about friendship. And it is also about coping with loss. And so it is really a good book. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.